Welcome back to another edition of the Fried Egg Podcast. Today's podcast is brought to you by our friends at BeDratty. Just like the greatest golf architects, BeDratty is all about the meticulous attention to detail. Every product is designed with intention, just like the Chadwick Gingham button-down shirt. I just picked up one of these, and it is a game changer. It has quickly become one of my favorites. I love a little bit of a off-course style, post-round style that they have created at BeDratty. The fabric is wonderful. It's got that snappy feel and a spread collar that has built-in memory wire collar stay. So you're not going to get a sloppy collar, which nobody wants a sloppy collar. Why hasn't anybody else thought of that? That's what I wonder. Like, why aren't there more conversations about sloppy collar? And of course, it's made using many of the techniques that made their polos so popular and obviously easy to dress up or dress down. Today's episode, I am joined by longest reigning, almost 2 years reigning, U.S. Mid-Am champ, Lucas Michel. Lucas has been on a grand golf tour of America since he came back over for the USAM and US Open. He's been working with Mike DeVries on a restoration renovation of Bloomfield Hills in Michigan also. So we talk about his Masters prep as well as what he's been up to the last few months and a lot of the great golf courses he's played. So Lucas is somebody that I'm pulling for next week, and hopefully you guys all become fans of his. Without further ado, here is Lucas Michel. And of course, if you missed our first conversation, we talked after his U.S. Mid-Am win. So you can check that out from a little over a year ago now. One quick note also, sorry, I said without further ado already, but one other quick note, we will have extensive Masters coverage on the website, on the podcast. This is the first of many episodes coming, as well as newsletters and articles on the site. So the easiest way to stay up to date is to sign up for our newsletter. Masters Week, it will be a daily newsletter. Go to the website, thefriedegg.com. There is a bar right there that sign up for our free email newsletter. Just enter your email there. It'll get you locked in, and you won't miss anything that we put out this week. Will Knights does an awesome job with the newsletter. You know, Garrett, I, and Will be pumping out articles and fresh stuff all week long. So sign up for the newsletter at thefriedegg.com, and thank you for listening to the podcast.
I miss a green, for example. I'm already upset. When I find my ball in the bunker, I'm really upset. And when I find my ball in a
fried egg.
Fried egg.
The dreaded fried egg.
Fried egg.
Fried egg.
Fried egg.
Fried egg.
Fried egg lie, I'm about ready to run off the golf course.
That's a really good short four, isn't it, with the creek on
the
left?
Yeah.
Yeah. We saw him there, and I said, like, you've come, like, that was the only time we saw him. I was like, oh, you've come at the right time. Like, this is a great hole, and we're talking about that. But
did he roll up with his cart without the top, his convertible cart?
I think he was using a proper cart at that point. Oh. But, no, he was a good guy. We actually went and checked out Wake Forest's little facility as well out the back. So he took us through the little fence. I don't know if you've been through
there. Yeah.
There's like a little back way through the fence and that. And that's pretty cool setup over there too. But
I know.
It was a good day. I've had a really good trip, like, overall.
You missed out on college golf.
Oh, I know. I'm completely missed out. I thought about coming over for it, but it was never really, it's hard from Australia. Not many Aussies go. Unless you're, like, really good.
Yeah, I'm trying to think. It's always because you see all, like, the random guys. I always, like, laugh about, like, seeing, like, somebody from Norway playing golf, college golf at Texas Tech in Lubbock, Texas. And I'm like, God, you know, this goes from Norway to Lubbock, Texas. It's got to be, like, the most ultimate culture shock. But Australians, you guys just turned pro.
Yeah, we've got pretty good, like, high performance programs. And for a while, I think in, like, the late 90s, there was a lot of kids from Australia going to college. And then Australia realized that they should probably do something to try and like match the college system. So they started like this Australian Institute of Sport, and then all the states in Australia created these sporting institutes and with like scholarships of their own, and that kind of attracted people away from America. So that's sort of what they do. I don't know. I think the college system is really good. I think the competition, the level of competition, you can't beat it. Mm-hmm. Whether the coaching and that side of things actually develops the players as good is maybe questionable. But if you want to just play against the best players in the world in that age, and college golf's the way to do it.
Yeah. What did you think of Old Town?
Yeah, it's awesome. I'd been so, I mean, it's been a pretty cool trip. I've been to like everywhere, but I liked it probably every bit as much as Pinehurst number 2. I thought it was, because Pinehurst number 2 is like a funny one. Like, I really don't know how I feel about Pinehurst number 2. I don't know where it sits for me, because the land's good, but not great. And it's obviously sand and all that, but and the green complexes are interesting, but there's not that much variety in them, because they're all kind of crowned. And then it's really hard, obviously. I don't know. I like it as a golf course, but I'm not sure if it's as good as it's made out to be. I don't know. That's just like my little impression of it. Like Old Town Club was awesome. I mean, it's such a more undulating, varied kind of property with creeks and lots of interesting natural features running through it. And on top of that, it's a really good routing that uses the land really well. It's just like, if I was comparing that to Pinehurst, I just felt like there was more to offer at Old Town Club than Pinehurst. But I mean,
it's interesting. I always think of Pinehurst number 2 as like a sum of all parts golf course. Like there's no weaknesses. Mm. Like, and the stretch of, I think one of the things that gets lost is like that stretch of like 3 through 6 at Pinehurst number 2 is really good, but it comes early, right?
And that's probably where the land is best. If you're probably going to talk about like where the land movement's best and using the natural features and all of that. So yeah, for sure. That's where that course probably pops. And you're right, it's early in the round, so you probably come away maybe a little kind of forgetful of how good those early holes are. But obviously like 16, 17, or 15, 16, 17 and 18 are great as well. So
it's like, that's like one of the things where I always like think about with like really great golf courses, like what's the worst hole there? And then at Pinehurst number 2, it's really hard to pick the worst hole.
Yeah. I think if but I was...
the highs might not be as high.
Yeah. Like there's no real weak holes. I think there's... Is it 11 and 12 that are like kind of... they're a little disconnected from the routing. Like all the other holes are kind of like in amongst each other. And then those two are kind of like an extra hole's width away from the other holes, and they kind of just sort of sit out there on their own. You kind of go out, back. They're sort of the same distance roughly and a lot of similar features. They're probably the only two that kind of like maybe kind of blend into one in my mind, but they're still really good holes in their own right. They're just kind of a little disconnected from the other.
Yeah, and they're pretty flat, that part of the land. It's like, I know in that part of the, like, you know, I haven't been there a bunch of times. Like you can kind of lose track of like, what hole is that? Like, just like what you did. Like I've had that same moment in my, it's like, is that 11, that 12? Like it's, I completely get how you feel about Pinehurst number 2. I really like the golf course, but that's where like memorability, I think, but it's really good when you look at everything. But Old Town, I agree, spectacular. Yeah. The neat thing I think about Old Town is, and Garrett asked, we did a podcast on Old Town, and Garrett asked me this question. I'm curious your thoughts. Do you think there's, like, what would you do to make Old Town better?
there's probably not much. It's pretty severe land. Like, it's pretty severe land. So I think they've pretty much got as much out of it as they could. There's probably a couple tee shots where you feel like it's maybe a touch awkward, but like the intimacy of the routing and how well it does use the land, like you're always going to have like a couple shots, given how severe it is. I think you're always going to have a couple shots that just feel a little like they kind of got stuck with this little corner of the property and they had to use that on a tee shot. I think, I'm trying to remember, like, I think, what is it, like,
four
a little bit. There's a couple of those like semi-blind ones where, or even like nine to an extent, like it kind of, it's a little too severe, the side slope and everything kind of runs into the right, and then you've got a few maybe trees that are in your way on the right, just like tiny little stuff, but it's not, I mean, it's uses the land as good as anywhere.
See, that's why I kind of came, it's like if you went out there and you're like, okay, like almost every course in America, I feel like you can go out and you can be like, you know what, you're at like 80% of what you could be, you know, and that place, and a lot of it is credit to Dunlop White, who's out there, the greens chair, and then Bill Kaur. That place is maxed out pretty much. It deserves so much praise because it's actually a golf club that has fully realized their golf course's, you know, capabilities and what it is.
It is. It, like, there's hardly a tree limb that you'd trim or, you know, a little slope that you might fix up. Like, it's, yeah, as good as it gets for what's there. It's awesome.
I had Colin Sheehan on, who's the coach of Yale and one of the founders of the Outpost. He thought it was so similar to Augusta. And I'm curious, you're obviously getting ready to play the Masters next week. And I'm assuming you've been out there a couple times. How would you compare Old Town and Augusta?
We actually spoke about it today. I was chatting to Will. As soon as I got a couple holes in, I was like, well, this is perfect preparation because the greens were rolling at like 12. They got heaps of slope on them. They're bent grass, which is unusual for this area. And there's a lot of sloping lies in the fairways. And I mean, it really is like perfect preparation. I wish I'd had a few extra days. I probably would have bunkered down here and, you know, try to play it a few more times. But I think there's not too many courses that would have been better preparation than Old Town. You know, Augusta probably, it's not, Augusta's like a pretty wide golf course, but Old Town's probably got a little bit more forgiveness off the tee. And then it's obviously, Augusta's probably a touch longer, but I mean, in terms of prep, it's pretty damn close to the ideal place to be practicing. I'd say the greens at Old Town they're probably more canted than Augusta's, maybe. Like, Augusta's have a lot of internal movement, and I'm not sure if Old Town's have as much, but like that's tiny. Like they've still got heaps of slope on the greens at both courses, and yeah, it couldn't have been a better place to play around a golf today.
Yeah, I imagine with Augusta before the tree planting stuff and certain holes where, you know, like one of the neat things with Old Town is you hit a ball, say you hit a drive and you just catch it a little on the toe and you get a little draw spin and it's 5 yards left of where you want to hit it. Mm-hmm. It catches a slope out there and just shoots it and it'll roll 35 yards further away from where you want it to be. And I imagine that is a lot of the features that Augusta used to play like in the 90s or even earlier than that, where, you know, you just miss and it shoots it. And Augusta still has a lot of that in it.
Yeah, I think for sure. I think Old Town probably is the course Augusta should probably play and look a bit more like. You know, obviously Augusta hosts probably the most important golf tournament in the world. And part of that is probably challenging the best players in the world, but even if the aesthetic could just be changed a little bit more to look a bit more like Old Town's, that would probably be a good thing for golf. But it's tough because Augusta does a pretty damn good job at what they're doing, and you wouldn't want to change too much.
Yeah, yeah, it's hard. It's always hard. It's nitpicking, you know, with a lot of stuff. But you've got one of the more unique preparations for a major championship season of an amateur. Obviously, you're stuck in Australia, and now you're kind of stuck here.
Yeah.
But you know, you took you've been working on a restoration renovation project with Mike DeVries up in Bloomfield Hills Country Club. Talk a little bit about that experience and how did that all get set up?
I'll start probably. I mean, last time we chatted was September last year, just after I'd won, and at the time I'd been chatting to Mike Clayton about helping him out with some architecture stuff, because it's something that I've always been interested in. And I had like a little bit of technical background, like I studied an engineering degree, but it wasn't that relatable, but at least it kind of was something to kind of give me some sort of like knowledge in terms of like drawing up plans and engineering drawings and that sort of stuff. So Mike needed a little bit of help from that department. And then, so we, throughout like early 2020, we like went to a couple of courses, looked at a few things, but very minor stuff. And then COVID happened. I actually went over the States, went to Augusta, actually prepped at Augusta. And then that was like March 15. So that was when everything went down. And so I ended up coming back home. I had to quarantine for 2 weeks, and then I got locked down completely. So I couldn't touch a club for like, it was a total of about, well, I could touch a club, but I couldn't play golf for, it was like 8 or 9 weeks. So I was just hitting balls in a net in my backyard for like 8 weeks.
You had like a home, I remember the Instagrams, you had like a home gym set up in your front yard.
Yeah. I had like, it was like the most ghetto looking setup, because I rent a house from Metropolitan Golf Club where I'm a member, and it's in a reasonable area, but like I get a really good deal on the rent. So it's like a little bit run down the house. And there's like a lot of like from the previous owner, there's like a lot of like bricks and like plumbing parts and all this other stuff in the backyard. So I, with my housemate, who's the assistant pro at the club, we like made this makeshift gym, and then we had like this net set up that was like, I mean, it's a miracle that balls didn't go flying through the net into the neighbors and all that. But I had a track man there, so I could actually do some pretty decent practice.
That's great. You got a net that you're not sure, a shoddy net that you're not sure could keep the balls in, but you got a $30,000 track man.
And then, yeah, exactly. And then the contrast between my gym setup and then like Rory McIlroy in his like home gym in Jupiter, I don't know where he lives, where he's just like working out on his Peloton, and then he's got his like $100,000 gym setup. It was pretty funny because we're both prepping for effectively the same tournament. But so it was interesting. I didn't get to play much golf for 10 weeks or so, and then golf opened up and I got to play a little bit, but there was no tournaments. And then in August, I sort of, USAM was sort of touch and go whether it was going to go ahead, and it ended up that it would go ahead, so I came over for that. But prior to that, I'd spoke to Mike Clayton, and obviously he's now in partnership with Mike DeVries and Frank Pont in CDP Golf, Clayton DeVries Pont. So I kind of, it worked out really well timing-wise, because Mike DeVries was starting a project at Bloomfield Hills Country Club in near Detroit, August 1, and I was heading to the States August 6 to go to the Bandon, USAM at Bandon, and then straight after Bandon I would have like 5 weeks between that and the US Open. So I ended up heading to Bloomfield Hills. I didn't really at the time, I didn't know anything that detailed about golf course construction or growing or anything like that, so it was a good opportunity for me to learn a lot more in that department. So I spent 4 weeks at that point with Mike, just learning some hands-on golf course construction, design and construction, like basically everything. I was hopping in bunkers, digging bunkers, edging lips, and you know, filling them with sand, helping fill them with sand, the crew from Labar Golf Renovations, which is one of the big contractors. So, but it was also fascinating. Like I do that, but it was fascinating just watching Mike operate a bulldozer as well. I mean, there's probably not too many people in the industry that have as many hours on a bulldozer as Mike DeVries. So watching him like shell out bunkers and then like the crew from Labar coming in and, you know, Mike could sort of mark out where he wanted the edge. And then the guy that they had from Labar was just a genius on an excavator, and he would just, you know, finish it up to exactly how Mike wanted it. It was pretty cool to watch. And I got to hop in a bulldozer. I probably only spent a few hours overall on the whole trip, because it was a pretty expedited sort of project they were trying to get.
Yeah, it seemed like it came together really quick.
Yeah, it was like it was every single bunker on the course rebuilt. I think they added, overall the bunker numbers stayed about the same. They might have added a couple extras, but overall it stayed about the same. But it was effectively like 70 new bunkers. There was green expansions on most greens, if not all of them, and then like sort of expansions of short grass areas as well around them. And then there was three brand new greens. So they redid a par three. They converted two par fours into a par three and a long par four, because that was like the existing or the original layout had a three and a four in that area. So they kind of restored that. And then they rebuilt another par three green that was kind of sort of crammed in near the clubhouse. So it was a lot of work. I think so it was started on August 1 and they were scheduled to finish October 31st, but I think it might have got pushed back a week or so. But basically it's just finished. So it was all done in, September, October, 3 months.
3 months,
yeah. So it was a pretty fast, expedited sort of project. But, I mean, so I spent 4 weeks at the initial stage between USAM and US Open, and then I went away, played US Open, and then I went back for another 3 weeks or so and kind of watched it almost go to completion. So it was really cool to see it all unfold and look at how like someone like Mike sort of project manages it with the construction, the contractor, and all of that sort of stuff. It was really interesting.
As somebody that hadn't spent time on a project site, like what was the thing that shocked you the most? Was there anything that you're like, whoa, I didn't realize?
I think this is probably unique to Mike DeVries, but I was stunned at how much time he spent on site. Like, I think he's probably a little bit unique in the industry. Like everyone talks about, you know, like the new age golf course architects, sort of the design and builders, and they spend a lot more time on site. But Mike DeVries legitimately spends 7 a.m. till 7 p.m. on site 6 days a week. And if they're running behind or they get a bad weather day, he'll be there on Sunday as well for, you know, another 8 hours or so. So he legitimately spends almost every waking hour on a golf course in a bulldozer 80% of the time. It was pretty crazy. But so that was probably the most surprising thing. I don't think that's specific to golf course construction or like in general, but that was like a very interesting thing I saw about how Mike DeVries works, which was, I mean, amazing. Like I've never seen anyone who would, you know, I can't imagine anyone else does it like that. It's really impressive.
Yeah, I always find it amazing. You touched on it earlier. It's like the excavator, the guys who are, you know, a shaper mm-hmm. working on an excavator is like the precision and how, like, you know, how minute their cuts can be on those bunker edges. And then they do they pat them down. It's unbelievable to see them work with that, you know, the bucket of the excavator and how they use like all parts of it to get the edge exactly how they want it. And,
yeah. It's like, so the guy they had, Mike basically specifically asked for this guy, Sammy, because he'd worked with him before. He's one of the Labar guys, and it's not like he's like, he doesn't even play golf. He doesn't know golf really, but he's built a lot of bunkers. So he kind of knows what they need to look like. And Mike could just say, you know, here's the edge. I want it kind of like this deep, whatever. and Sammy had just come in and just, it's like an extension of his arm. He's literally just like a guy, just like a little T-Rex arm, just like scraping away everything, patting it down, you know, scraping it off to the side and then scooping it up, and any excess material is just putting in a dumper to be driven away to a dump site. So it was like, it was literally like he had his arm just scaled up by like 100, and he was just out there just digging away and making this perfectly shaped bunker. It was awesome to watch.
They're almost more precise than me with an arm. Like if I went to the beach and tried to build something like what they build, I wouldn't be as good as they are in like not always great soil. It's just unbelievable to me. They're operating a heavy piece of machinery better than I could, you know, operate my hands on a sandy beach.
Yeah, it's crazy. Yeah, those guys are so good.
So you saw a ton of stuff. Did you see a bunch of stuff in Michigan while you were there?
Yeah, I went up. It was interesting. I went to Crystal Downs with Mike. He's a member there, but also he worked in the bag room from the age of 14, and then he worked on the golf course maintenance from 17 to like through college until he's like 24, and then he got the job at High Point with Tom, sort of helping out there. So, I mean, he pretty much went from, like growing up at Crystal Downs to then becoming a member there and now being a golf course architect. So I walked around the course twice with him at Crystal Downs, which was just incredible. Like there's not too many people better that you'd want walking you around Crystal Downs. You know, him and Tom Doak are probably two guys that have a pretty good understanding of that golf course. And you could argue that Mike's got even more experience at that golf course than Tom, which is pretty incredible. And then Kingsley Club, we went up there, played there, which was like another awesome golf course. You could see how much Crystal Downs sort of influenced his design there at Kingsley, because they're on very quite similar plots of land in a similar area with similar vegetation and that. So
I see so much Maxwell and Mike's stuff. Like even Old Town, I see a lot of like old, you know, and obviously because of Crystal Downs and, you know, but like just the way he built greens with the, you know, the simplistic, you know, he kind of muffins and rolls in them.
Yeah. It's kind of sad that the only De Vries course I've played is Kingsley. I haven't been down to Cape Wickham in Australia, which I need to see. And we didn't get the chance to go up to Marquette Grey Walls, but Kingsley's awesome. We also went to Belvedere up in Charlevoix.
That's a cool little spot, right?
Yeah, super cool. We love that. That place is awesome.
That's the perfect golf club. The little clubhouse. It's like
semi-private sort of deal. Like anyone can kind of get on there. It's not that expensive. It's awesome little course. Actually, it's actually not even that little of a golf course. It's quite a good test.
Mm-hmm. The greens out there are really neat too. You know, like it's funny because I feel like Willie Watson gets characterized by Olympic Club, but you go out there and it's like, God, this place has so much character and it's got a little spunk.
Yeah, they've expanded out things. I think it's Bruce Heppner that's done a lot of the work there. So things are like Mike said, like it was much improved since he was last there. So it was cool to see it. It was really good. And then down sort of nearer Detroit, we kind of saw a lot actually near Detroit. We'd kind of go every Sunday when he had the day off, he'd take me out to somewhere new. So like Meadowbrook, which is really cool, really funky. It's wild.
I like, you know, Andy Staples who did that. I always say, like, you know what? He didn't chicken out at all.
No, you know? Crazy. Look, Mike couldn't believe it. He was like, how did he get this through the membership? Like,
that's what I'm amazed about.
Greatest sell of all time. But yeah, that place is so cool. And then like Franklin Hills, which is Donald Ross, which coincidentally was like 400 yards from where I was staying. Like it was legitimately like just around the corner, which was cool. I went out there with the superintendent who took me around and that was really fun.
He's a good dude, Brian. Super.
Yeah, Brian. Yeah, he's awesome. So that was good to see. Indian Wood, which probably has as much potential as anywhere.
That place drives me insane.
Yeah, the place is so cool. If I could just spend a little bit of money to expand out some greens there and just, yeah, some mowing line stuff. But other than that, it's still awesome to see.
Yeah. That land, it reminded me of Shinnecock, the land out there.
Yeah, I've not been to Shinnecock, but I mean, it's incredible. Like sandy rolling undulation looked like it was so cool.
I put that on like the all potential list. Like I would, if you gave somebody like Mike or Tom or, you know, the ability to do greens and bunkers there and fix the mowing lines. Oh my God. Like, because the greens in the surrounds are kind of repetitive out there, but God, that place could be unbelievable.
Yeah, it's really cool. What else? Orchard Lake we went up to, which was really cool as well.
Yeah.
And I played Detroit Golf Club as well when I was there. So I got a pretty good look at sort of golf in Michigan when I was there, which was really cool because I didn't realize how good of a golfing city Detroit is, and then how good of a golfing state. I didn't get up to like Arcadia Bluffs or anywhere like that, but or
the Loop,
you know, Forest, the Loop, but up there. But I got a pretty good look at some of the old school stuff mainly, and then a few of like Mike's stuff at Crystal Down at Kingsley Club, which was cool.
What and then you did a big Boston trip too and Philly. Man, you were all over the place. You've been living the dream.
Yeah, it was. I mean, it's been a really good trip. I never expected to play this much golf when I was here, but at the Open, I kind of could have gone to probably played some golf on Long Island after the US Open, but my caddy Will Davenport has spent the last two and a half years in Philadelphia. Mm-hmm. He was studying, he's doing his MBA up at Wharton. And so he's a really good mid-am player and had a bunch of contacts in Philly. So we lined up a really good trip out in Philadelphia. So we played, I think the first course we played was Rolling Green, which is awesome.
That's kind of reminiscent of Old Town too, with the land.
It is, yeah. Yeah. So Rolling Green was really cool. Where'd we go next? We went to Stonewall Old, which was really cool as well. Love that 18th hole. So cool. I remember reading about it actually in the Getting to 18 book about how Tom had like rerouted that to be right next to the clubhouse, which is cool. Philly Cricket, which is awesome. I'd been and I'd played the Militia Hill course there a couple of years ago, but they had a tournament on the Wissahickon. So I got to play the Wissahickon this time, which was awesome.
We got a joke with some buddies that those courses, if you told them, like, they sound like they're made up courses, like Wissahickon, Militia Hill, you know, it's like a ridiculous name.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
But awesome spot.
Yeah, it's awesome. Yeah. And then we played Pine Valley and Marion on the weekend, which was like topped off the trip. We also played, actually, I forgot, we played Hidden Creek as well, which is North Renshaw down there, kind of more near Jersey Shore kind of area. And that's awesome too. Like really kind of subtle, doesn't try to, you know, try and do too much. It's kind of like lots of greens on the ground and kind of, it's really cool. But Pine Valley and Marion to finish the week was pretty nice as well. So it was my second time playing Pine Valley. I played it a couple years ago, but we got a nice day for it. And I mean, golf doesn't get any better than Pine Valley.
Trip of a lifetime.
Yeah. Yeah.
Talk about the Open. How was that experience? That, obviously, playing first major championship for you.
Yeah, it was tough. Like the course was set up really tough. The toughest part for me, and I think it probably was all the amateurs as well, was the amateurs didn't really have a good schedule through summer. Like there wasn't really a lot of events to lead into the Open with. So in a way, it was like, I think everyone, all the amateurs kind of came in a little rusty out of kind of practice. You know, as much as you can hit balls and beat balls at your home track, there's nothing quite like playing a bunch of tournaments through summer. And I think, I mean, one amateur made the cut in the end, which is, you know, given that there was 12 out there and I think the top seven on the world amateur golf rankings got exempt. So there was a lot of good amateurs playing that event to have only one make the cut was probably more a reflection of the amateur schedule just being so disrupted. Whereas, you know, the pros were playing, they had a bunch of events to lead into the event with. But I mean, I played okay.
It's interesting. Talk about, you know, just leading into event, like just what you noticed with your game not being as sharp. Where do you see
stuff? Yeah. For me, it's like the toughest part, or the area I've been struggling with lately, was getting off the tee. Just putting it in position off the tee. That's something that, I don't know, without playing tournaments, I was really, really struggling with. I'm not sure if it's like the pressure when you've got an event, or you've got a bunch of events on you, you get used to like just getting into your pre-shot routine and getting all your preparation before you hit it right. But something about not playing a bunch of events just had me, I was just hitting it everywhere off the tee, which wasn't ideal at winged foot. So that hurt me. And then just little stuff around the greens. Like, I mean, winged foot can make you look stupid around the greens. Those greens are crazy. But I mean, on, for example, on the final, or the second round, my final round, the second round, I hit it greenside for two on the ninth. The ninth was my last hole. And so I've got like a basic 20 yard chip. I went like a little bit through the green. I've got a basic like 20 yard chip. I chip it like a little too firm and it rolls down. It's like sitting up against the collar, probably only 10 or 12 feet from the hole. And then I tried to putt it, but because it was up against the collar, I kind of tried to hit a little bit harder in case the putter grabbed. And then I hit it like 8 feet past. And then I really want to hold the putt for par, because I actually had a reasonable round going. If I hold it for par, I think I shot 75 on the second round, which was actually like respectable in those conditions, because I think the scoring average was like 76 that day, or 75 point something. So I'm like trying to hold this putt, and then I ram it like 4 feet past, and then I miss the 4 footer and I make double when I was like greenside for two on a par five. I'm just thinking like, how did that happen? Like,
yeah.
So it was just like stuff like that, where like if I was playing a lot more tournament golf, I feel like at least one of those shots I would have done better on and would have walked away with a five.
It's almost like everything just moves a little faster.
Yeah, it's, and it can get away from you really fast.
Mm-hmm.
I noticed that on the back nine of my first round. I played pretty good on the front nine. I think I was like even par through nine holes in the first round. And then I like made bogey on 10, actually made a really good bogey save on 10. I hit it like left of the green, and then I like hit a good flop shot that caught the rough and just stayed up, and then chipped it down and hold like a 20 footer for par, for bogey. But then I like made, I think I made double on 11 and just like got on this like little bogey train. And then before I could look up and check my score, I was like seven over for the back nine. And then I tripled the last, which was really nice as well, after hitting a 63-yard tee shot, which ricocheted. Thanks to ShotLink, they told me it was 63 yards, but it ricocheted off the chute on 18, ricocheted back almost onto the 17th green. It was legitimately like,
it was like someone, a lock of shame.
Yeah, the group behind, I like was like, this is so embarrassing. And they even brought out, like, there was a guy with like a standalone camera that came out to like video me while I was there. I was like, oh, please, not now. I need to get my caddy to run in front of him, like Bryson.
Yeah, you got to protect the brand. You know?
Exactly.
It's brand 101 for, you know,
yeah,
golfer.
Yeah, so that was embarrassing. And I actually should have still walked away with a bogey. Like I could have played straight down the 11th fairway on the east course, because it was like the easiest little shot down there, and then like a 7-iron over the trees. But I managed to put it between the 11th east and the 18th west, and then I was like behind a tree, and then ended up three putting on top of that. So I made triple. So
that's a great way to end a round.
Beautiful.
Yeah. So what do you think about Wingfoot in general, like as a, you know, championship course and setup wise? It's been a few months. I'm curious.
I spoke to a few people about it. I actually think for some reason, well, I kind of know the reason, but the setup actually made angles sort of matter. I don't know if anyone else has mentioned this, but the fairways were narrow, but like you had to be on the right side of the fairway slash the correct rough line to actually attack greens. So you didn't want to be, for instance, the first hole doglegs left opens up, the green opens up from the right. If you're in the left rough, you're toast. But if you're in the right rough, you're fine. So I was aiming like down the right side of the fairway, trying to open up the angle to the pin if I hit in the rough. And the fairways were so narrow, like it was actually really hard to hit the fairway. So you'd rather kind of just hedge toward the rough line to avoid being in the wrong rough line. And then like the second was the opposite. And the second you'd hit it, try to go for the left rough line because you knew that you could open up the green from the left. And it was kind of weird how the setup, I guess because the rough was so thick, but it was kind of uniform as well. So like you could draw a bad lie, but most of the time you could advance it without any spin on it, like 130 yards or something like that. So you'd be kind of just hedging your angles like to hit it in the just the correct rough line so you could kind of approach the green properly. So
and if you pull it or push it down the rough line, you're in the middle of the fairway.
Exactly. Yeah, you hit a block down the second and you're in the middle of the fairway. You pull it, you're probably still able to punch out through the trees and get it somewhere near the green. Whereas sometimes like the second, if you push it in the right trees, it's a pretty tricky shot to kind of get something in play from there.
With those fairways like 22 yards wide and how does that compare to like Augusta? The lines that you take at Augusta, I mean, I'm assuming you're shading towards certain areas, but it's not anything like that, right?
Yeah. Well, it's a lot more of aiming toward the middle of the fairway, I guess, because I mean, there's obviously some fairways out there where the angle kind of matters a bit more. Like maybe the third hole, you can kind of like, you're thinking about which side of the hole, depending on where the pin is. But most of the time, I think you're probably aiming closer to the middle at Augusta, just because like a lot of the greens are pretty open from the front. The rough's not as thick, so you're going to be able to get a little bit of spin out of the rough. There's a little bit more opportunity to recover from out of play areas at Augusta, whereas Wingfoot, it was like you really, if you're out of play in the wrong spot, you would just chipping out to somewhere where you could get it back in play. But yeah, Augusta, you can get a little bit more creative with your recovery shots than at Wingfoot, I think.
In terms of the Masters, you know, what are there areas of your game that you've been particularly focused on leading up that you've been working on?
I'd say if I've got a weakness, like compared to most tour pros, it's my ball striking just isn't anywhere near as sharp as like the best players in the world. I think my putting's pretty solid and my short game's decent normally, but where I kind of lose out is like I hit it long enough, but I just hit it too erratically. So I've been working a lot more on trying to just hit it better, like a bit of technical stuff. But then more recently, I've just been hitting a lot of different shot shapes and trying to kind of get a little bit more creative with my shot making. I find that when I'm like in the trees and have to hit a shot that does something, I always am way more committed to hitting the shot and seem to execute a lot better when I've got something specific to hit. Whereas like if I'm in the middle of the fairway and it's like I'm trying to hit a dead straight shot to the middle of the green, for some reason I just hit bad golf shots from there. And I can't really figure out why. So more recently I've been trying to like hit almost shapes from the middle of the fairway and trying to like work it different ways. And I've been sort of finding that I can vary my distance with shot shaping. So like if I hit a 8-iron 170 yards like stock standard, like with a little draw, which is like my normal shot shape, I can hit it 175 if I try and draw it, or I can hit it 165 if I try and fade it. So I can kind of like, I've been sort of playing around with just different ways to vary how far it goes, and that kind of gets me more committed to hitting better golf shots when I'm kind of in the middle of the fairway, which you'd think would be the easiest place to hit from. But for some reason, I've been just pretty poor from approach play in that part.
Do you think like when it's windy, I imagine you feel the same way? Yeah, yeah, because you just, you're more yeah. engaged, your mind's yeah. more activated.
Yeah, I played the Azalea Amateur, or the Azalea.
I was going to ask you about this.
Yeah, played that last week, and it was really windy the first two rounds. And I played great the first two rounds. I think I shot 68 and 70. So, like, I was four under through two rounds. And then rounds three and four, three was still pretty windy. And round four was like dead still. And I think I shot 77, 74 to finish. Like, it was like, and honestly, the last round was like dead still. I don't know. There's something about, yeah, when you're forced to do something, there's like almost no options on how to play a shot. You know, it's played one way and not any other ways. My level of commitment walking into the ball and ability to execute seems to be a lot better, but yeah, put me in the middle of the fairway with no wind and an easy pin and I'll find some way to screw it up.
It's interesting. When I used to play, I always felt like when it was windy, I was like, I always, it was randomly, I'd play better. And it was like, you know, like you space out almost. You take, you get complacent, I think, is when there's not stuff going on sometimes. What'd you think of a country club of Charleston?
Yeah, it's awesome, that place. It's so much fun. The Redan, actually, Redan. Yeah, it's off its head. I actually birdied the first two rounds. So I was two under for two plays.
I'm looking at your card. You played a two under for the week. That's unbelievable.
Yeah. So I actually played that hole really well. But yeah, it's sweet. I mean, I've actually not played that many Seth Rainer golf courses. I went to Yeaman's Hole as well when I was there last week. And so I saw that place as well, which probably is the best Seth Rainer I've seen. I played Fox Chapel as well, but I think Yeaman's takes the cake as far as I've seen. But yeah, Charleston's awesome as well. Like almost a dead flat site.
Yeah.
I think those sort of like more bolder kind of Rainer style golf courses, I've not seen a lot, but like they seem to work really well when the architect had almost nothing to work with. Like you can create something really interesting out of almost nothing. Like there's not many natural features there to work with.
Well, it just shows like how you can make something really interesting and carry interest with just a really good green, you know?
Yeah. I've always thought as well, like people talk about minimalism in golf course design. And I think in a way, like that sort of architecture where it's literally just cut and fill and leaving everything really kind of sharp and not really massaging it out into like tying it in. That's actually probably what minimalism should be called, because that's like they're kind of just doing it and like leaving everything as it was. Like they're not actually even bothering to like try and tie it in. It's kind of like it's like I'd call like the other type of golf course architecture like naturalism or something like that.
Yeah.
But I feel like that's sort of minimalism when you're kind of just leaving it. Like all that early golden age stuff as well, like Walter Travis and that sort of stuff. That's kind of minimalism in my mind, because it literally is just like moving it as minimal as possible, the dirt.
I always say, I would say Rainer, Banks, Langford Moreau, those guys were like the golden age maximalists or today's minimalists. Yeah. You know, that's what I always say. It's like, because their construction sites probably look like a Mike DeVries or a Tom Doak or, you know, Bill Court construction site these days, where there's some heavy machinery out there, but in the grand scheme of things, they're doing very little.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Like they're doing, in a way, less because it looks so abrupt and maximal. Like it's just a different look, I think.
Yeah. And with those greens, you know, propped up. And it's like when they put pins and corners out there, you got to be so good. Because you can set those, especially that golf course up, you could set it up for the Azalea Am for guys to go out and shoot nothing, you know?
Yeah.
But then if you put the pins in the corners, all of a sudden you got to be really golfing your ball.
Yeah. It's kind of like the sandbelt. You can cut the pins so close to the edges of the greens, because obviously the sandbelt, you've got no fringes between like greens and bunkers, whereas at like Country Club of Charleston or other Rainer courses where the greens are really mowed out so close to those like abrupt edges, you can pin it. Like, I think they had a pin on the second round on the seventh hole, and it was in the left part of the green, and it would have been like a pace and a half off the left edge. So it was the coolest shot because everyone sort of bailed out left. It's sort of like a short par four. Everyone would bail out left and they'd hit it in this rough, and they couldn't get it within 40 feet of the hole. Whereas if you kind of took the correct line and try to, I think it's a cape template.
Yeah.
Try and go down the right along the hazard line, and then you can actually open up the pin. So that was cool to see that. But yeah, that's kind of the only way they can defend a golf course from players like at my level, is just like make them quick and make them firm and put the pins in corners, and they can actually legitimately defend it though from par, because it's they can be so creative with those pins.
Yeah, I thought one of the cool things too with those two courses, like Yeamans and Country Club Charleston, you see like the different, like Yeamans a little bit more understated because it's got better topography than the, you know, Country Club of Charleston. It's got, such bold features because, like we talked about, just nothing really going on the site. And it's interesting with Rainer, I notice it here in Chicago, it's very similar with Shore Acres. He's got this intricate ravine system that runs through it, and there it has much more tame greens than at Chicago Golf, where it's a nice site, but it's not, you know, anything crazy. And there it has greens that are similar to Country Club of Charleston.
Yeah. I definitely think he knew where to like tone it down. I'd like to see Fishers. I haven't been up to Fishers Island, but I don't know if you've been there, but that'd be fun to see.
Yeah. It's cool.
Because wasn't Rainer supposed to build Cypress Point as well? Was that like the original?
Yeah, that was the. So they always say he did a routing for Cypress Point, and then obviously he died. He was building MPCC too, Dunes course there.
Yeah.
And I think Robert Hunter, I think, actually finished that plan. So it was, but then they obviously redid that. Fishers is neat. I think Fishers, Fishers is great, and it's an idyllic place to play golf. I mean, anywhere you're playing on an ocean, is how could you ever complain? But, you know, of the, like, top flight Rainers, it definitely has, like, the most weak holes, but it also has some of the most spectacular holes. So it's like, how do you weigh it? But, like, you know, it probably has four of the weakest holes of, you know, any of the, if you put Yeamans, Shore Acres, Chicago Golf, and Yale in a bucket. Yeah. Those, you know, Fishers has the most weak holes of any of them. But it also is set on, you know, Fishers, the experience is unbelievable. You know, you take the ferry out there and, you know, it's a great golf course. And the stretch of holes from 3 through 12 is absolutely astounding and as good of a stretch as anywhere in golf.
Yeah, it'd be interesting to see what he would have done at like a site like Cypress Point, where, you know, Mackenzie probably the ultimate kind of working with nature, like not trying to overpower the site in a way. Like he was probably the perfect match for that site, but to see what someone like Rainer would have done there would be really interesting.
I'm interested if you notice anything, being somebody from the Melbourne Sandbelt, Mackenzie's work in Melbourne versus Mackenzie's work at like Crystal Downs, where he worked with Maxwell or even Augusta. Yeah. If you notice any difference from stylistic or anything, because obviously like the associates were such, you know, the Morecambes in Australia.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's interesting. Like Royal Melbourne, the greens, compared to like, I haven't actually seen that much Mackenzie outside of Australia. Like I've seen obviously Crystal Downs, I haven't seen Cypress Point. So I've really got only a small sample size of Mackenzie courses. Like Augusta I have seen, but it seems like Mackenzie would put pretty bold internal contour into his greens. Like that does seem like a pretty key Mackenzie feature. And if I was going to talk about the Melbourne Sand Belt, I would say that's probably not a feature you really see, particularly like the only course he really built was Royal Melbourne West. He did the routing there. The other courses, he didn't do the routing. So the routing at Royal Melbourne West is awesome. Like, it doesn't get much better. But if you look at the, he only built, I think he was only on site for the construction of the fifth green on the West course, which is that iconic three that everyone's seen photos of. That was the only green he actually saw completed. So that's fine. That green's kind of got like a pretty severe tilt in it. It doesn't have a lot of internal contouring in the greens. It's generally like, it'll be like a 3% slope kind of throughout the green, and then there'll be like a bunch of like subtle rolls, but it's not really like you'd see at Augusta, like on the fifth green, where it's got like a massive abrupt shape in it, which I assume is original. I don't know enough about the history there to know it, but like stuff like that, I haven't seen, or like Mackenzie's, like the boomerang green at Crystal Downs, like nothing along those lines. It's definitely like the green complexes don't have like heaps of internal contour, I wouldn't say, or any like super abrupt contours. It's more just like subtle slopes, which I guess Mackenzie only spent, I think it was like 5 or 6 weeks actually in Melbourne. And he was consulting a lot of golf courses. Like, it obviously Royal Melbourne was, he was brought down by the Royal Melbourne Golf Club committee, but he also like subsidized the trip with
Kingston,
with Heath, sort of like working for other golf courses. So he went and saw Royal Adelaide, and then went and saw, you know, Kingston Heath and Victoria and Metro. So like, he wasn't, I don't think he actually had that much influence on the construction of the golf course. I mean, he was gone well before it was finished. So it's kind of, I'd say it's a lot more Morecambe and Russell around the greens.
So when do you get down to Augusta? You getting down there this weekend, or, you know, and then what's the plan? Are you staying in the Crow's Nest? What's your game plan?
Yeah, so I'm heading to Augusta on Sunday. Could have got there Saturday. I think Saturday's the earliest you can get there. I could have like done like a pre-visit, but Saturday's the earliest day for like the tournament where you get COVID tested and that. But Sunday was sort of early enough, so I'll get tested on Sunday. I might walk it Sunday afternoon because I got to wait for my test to come back, and there's a couple things I'd probably want to see as well. Like, the yardage books almost don't have any information on them that you get for the tournament. So I've got one. I got it when I went there last time, but because I did a little visit in March, but they don't have any like up down measurements. The greens are pretty blank. What else? It's all, you need to really go and see it a little bit more to fill that stuff out. So I'll probably go down with a slope rangefinder and just put in all the slope measurements with my caddy and walk that on Sunday afternoon. And then, yeah, start sort of practice rounds on Monday.
Do you have those?
I listened to a podcast actually, not yet, but I listened to a podcast with Mark Leishman's caddy. I think it's Matty. I don't know his surname, but he did one with No Laying Up the other day, so that was cool. I've got a contact with Leishman, so I might try and set up something with him because they seem like pretty good guys to learn from. And I've still got Adam Scott's details from the US Open. I had a practice round with him, so I'd like to maybe line up those two together maybe on one of the days, which would be pretty cool.
An all Aussie pairing.
Yeah, and all Aussie. Well, that's what I got at the US Open for the actual stroke play. I don't know if you saw that, but I played with Lucas Herbert and Matt Jones, so that was kind of funny. But, it'd be interesting who I actually get paired up with for the tournament, because I know you always get a past winner. It would be cool to get someone like Adam Scott, given, you know, he's the first and only Aussie winner of the Masters, but I'm not sure I could quite get that sort of marquee kind of group, but we'll see.
You might get him, you know?
Yeah,
that makes sense, right?
Yeah.
Well, you're the first Aussie mid-am winner, right?
Correct. Yeah.
So, I mean, that's a natural tie. Cool. Masters loves their like stories like that.
Yeah. Yeah. So that'd be cool. It was actually really comforting playing with two Aussies for the US Open, because not that I knew Lucas pretty well, because he's from Victoria where I'm from, and I've known him for like 5 or 6 years, but I didn't know Matt, but you know, he's another Aussie, and we could talk about cricket and all these Aussie things that are mysterious to Americans. So
the comfy pairing, you know,
it was very comfy. Yeah. And it was good. I think Golf Australia liked it as well, because for them, you know, golf in Australia, they could just sort of play that as a, almost like a feature group if they wanted to. So
yeah. And the journalists, the journalists got, you know, they didn't have to follow a bunch of groups. They just got to go out and, you know, follow one group. What's his name? Evan Priest.
Evan Priest. Yeah.
Yeah. And Ben, Ben from the PGA Tour. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So no, it was cool. So hopefully I get a cool pairing. This is funny, today actually at Old Town when I played there, I caught up with DC, Punchbowl Pack DC. I think he's a member there, and he was playing with a couple friends of mine. And I might head out and have a
look. He was playing with Alex Fitzpatrick today, right?
Alex Fitzpatrick, and so two friends of mine. So one of Alex's friends from England, Barclay Brown, played the Azalea. Uh-huh. And another friend of mine, Henry Shimp, who also played the Azalea, who's at Stanford. So I caught up with them, but I didn't play with them. But I met DC, and we talked about the tree farm. So I'm staying in Aiken. He said he's going to be out there. Staying in Aiken. So I'll probably head out to the tree farm that week as well at some point. Zach's there one of the days.
Are you checking out Palmetto at all while you're down there?
I played Palmetto. I actually played it last year. I loved it. Actually, I played Mid Pines. Oh, sorry, I played Pine Needles, but I thought Mid Pines had a lot of Palmetto, like small scale, like just like really cool, like fine features, small greens. And so I played Palmetto last year and loved it. It was this year. It was because of COVID, I got kicked off the grounds at Augusta. They kind of closed up the course for COVID, and then I managed to get around in at Palmetto after that. So
off the course at Augusta, you know,
not really kicked off, but like politely we left the ground. We left the grounds. We had another round booked for the Tuesday, and because of COVID they'd closed it for basically at that point for the rest of the summer spring, I guess, or the rest of the spring. So we didn't get kicked off, but we left, and then they were like, oh, unfortunately, like, you won't be able to play Tuesday. But ended up playing Palmetto, which was awesome. So yeah, I love Palmetto. That's a cool place. I might head out there again. I played Aiken Golf Club as well, which was really cool too. I know you love that place. What they've done there is awesome.
I don't think there's a town in America, like a non-major city, that's got a better private public golf combo than Aiken, Georgia. Like, there's no town that's got a better private and public.
Smallest town, no. No. I don't know American geography well enough, but it'd be hard to beat, wouldn't it?
I think you could say George. I'm not sure if they're in the same town, but I think George Wright and the Country Club are like right next to each other. That would be one in Brookline or Massachusetts area. I might be wrong.
I was up there. We briefly spoke about that. I was up there in a couple of weeks ago when it went, had a pretty good trip through Boston. So
you live in everybody's dream.
Yeah, I didn't get to play Brookline because it was actually Gil Hance was there when I was there, but I missed him by like a few hours. But I chatted to one of his associates. Who's actually from Melbourne.
Ben.
Yeah, Ben. So Ben and I chatted. He took me around the course and then sort of showed me what they were doing. That was cool. So shout out to Ben Hillard. So that was fun. And then I went in Charles River down the road, which is really cool. Played there. It's a Donald Ross that got a few really cool green complexes and Catanzet and Myopia, which is like the coolest place in the world, and Essex County, which is probably my favorite out of the whole trip. So yeah, I've done well this trip in the US. I'm actually kind of stuck here.
Are you stuck? You can't get back now?
Well, I can get back, but it'll cost me like 10 grand to get home. It'll cost me a lot of money to get home. Basically, Australia has limited the number of arrivals into the country to a number that they can manage so that like COVID doesn't get out. So they limited it to 4,000 people per week. So that means that all the airlines coming into the country are limited to like 40 passengers per plane. And so what they're all doing is they're trying to fill their planes with business and first class passengers. And if there's any economy, they'll still like charge pretty high for. So I had 3 economy tickets booked back home. I had one for November 17 that got canceled like about a month or two ago. Then I had another one booked for December 1 because that was the nearest I could get, which got canceled maybe 2 weeks ago. And then I then rebooked on an American Airlines for December 2 that got canceled like maybe a few days ago, maybe 3 or 4 days ago. So I've had 3 tickets all booked on economy for like reasonable prices, like $1,000 one way, which is like pretty typical for an economy ticket, that have all been canceled. And now I'm looking at tickets because it's before Christmas. Yeah. And I'm now booking late because all the other ones have been canceled. I thought I had a ticket. Now I don't. So because now I'm like booking late, all the prices are just jacked up. So they're like $5,000 to go economy one way, or it's like 10 grand for business, or like, so basically I'm like, screw it. I'll probably end up waiting until after Christmas to get home. Basically, like I could try and get home to see my family for Christmas, but because my family are in Western Australia, they've completely closed the border. So I'd have to fly to Perth, which is like a really tricky place to get to. Mm-hmm. It's not going to work out that I'll see my family. So it kind of doesn't make sense for me to try and get back before Christmas because the prices are so high. Unless someone at Augusta manages to private jet me or something, that would be the only way I'm getting home. I might have to put my feelers out during the tournament. But
you gotta cozy up with Adam Scott.
Yeah, well, I spoke to him though. He's not going back home for Christmas either, because you got to quarantine in a hotel for 2 weeks as well, and you got to pay for it. It's like $3,000. So like, none of the Aussies are going to go home for Christmas. It's all a shambles. So yeah, I don't know what, I mean, I don't know what I'm going to do. I might try and find like another work experience project to help DeVries.
Somebody give Lucas a job.
Yeah. Give me a job. If someone who's got a golf project happening that needs a guy that has shovel experience to edge bunkers that also play the Masters, just let me know.
Yeah, we need the fried egg paid internship program to get rolling. Yeah, you know,
exactly.
Gotta figure something out. But maybe somebody will have some ideas. I'm sure they'll find a way to get a hold of you.
Yeah, yeah. I need to somehow fill my time before I can head home. So, but yeah, I've been playing a lot of good golf. So maybe there's more good golf on the cards.
Well, you know, if you play really well next week, that probably would take care of a lot of stuff.
That does. Yeah. If I play well, I could probably turn pro and pay for my way.
Exactly. That's what I'm thinking. So just play well next week. You got extra incentive.
Exactly. That's the plan.
All right. Well, good luck. Thanks for the time. I think everybody that listened to this is very jealous of you, even though you're not going to be able to get home for the holidays.
Yeah.
You know, I think that's probably a price that most people would pay for your last 6 months or so. So
it's a decent trade off. Yeah. I've played some, I think most of your golf sicko kind of listeners would be happily trade Christmas with their family for the schedule I've had. So
they wouldn't admit it to their wives or their kids, but
yeah, no, I'm in a good position overall.
Yeah. So, we'll hopefully see you playing all weekend long, and then, and people have somebody else to root for, but then, we'll touch base. If you need any recommendations, let me know.
Okay, sounds good. All right. Thanks, Andy.